In a sense, we have an ongoing dialogue about how we all got here. It's just that the parties to the dialogue are seldom in the same room and almost never in the same mindset. The polarization of politics does not help when we deal with issues as basic as whether life began spontaneously or whether God put us here. Today's guest is a medical doctor with his feet firmly in science. He travels around speaking about his research into evolution and encouraging some conversations back and forth between people who believe in evolution and people who stick to creationism. Dr. John Peters is a family practitioner in the Portland area and visiting Ashland for a couple of events with the Jefferson Center. No relation to Jefferson Public Radio, but a secular humanist operation. Dr. Peters, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be here.
It's good to have you here. Well, let's talk about your background. So you are an MD, a family physician. So how did you... I mean, so you're a man of science, obviously, but how develop such a strong interest in evolution and in, if you'll pardon the expression, preaching the gospel about it?
Yes. Well, I was a biology major as an undergraduate and finished a bachelor's degree in zoology from Arizona State University, and then went on to get a master's degree in biology from Northern Arizona University, and was an evangelical Christian for a few years from ages 17 to 20 or so, and was very much in tune with what I was being told from the pulpit, but it was difficult to combine those with what I was hearing in my science. And then after teaching at the college level for a number of years, I decided to go to medical school, put everything off as far as the evolution and creation controversy for about 20, 25 years to get into medicine and get my practice going. And then about 5 or 6 years ago, all of a sudden, I discovered that with the Human Genome Project coming out, that there were tremendous amounts of DNA evidence coming out that were linking humans to chimps and whale evolution, things like that, and just probably the best evidence we've ever had that macroevolution is true. And so I kind of jumped back in thinking that there may be some new information out there that can really simplify the controversy and the debates.
I'm curious about the between years, though, because you mentioned being an evangelical Christian until you were probably halfway through college, and then in the course of setting up your practice and stuff, as you wandered away from Christianity, it sounds like the whole thing got put on ice for a long time then. So in a sense, is your renewed interest in evolution a few years ago sort of like the time bomb from your Christianity years?
I think that, again, for me, it was discovering most of the DNA evidence that was coming out and probably the one thing that got me going and back into this after 20 years is that Francis Collins, who's a prominent evangelical Christian, he was the head of the NIH right now, and he did the Human Genome Project.
National Institutes of Health?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Founded BioLogos in 2007 with a Templeton grant. And he was reaching out to his fellow evangelical Christians, trying to introduce this new information about that there cannot be an Adam and Eve, and that the DNA evidence for our shared ancestry with chimps and other apes is just unbelievably strong now. And so just need to go to the BioLogos site and see what he's doing. And it's a very, very brave thing. He's alienated himself from a lot of other fellow evangelicals, but he's a very humble, very kind man with a good voice. And I think the DNA evidence is just so strong that many of the people who oppose evolution are having a very difficult time dealing with it right now. There are Christians out there who are calling this a Galileo moment, just like in 1633 with Galileo, where the church had trouble. The Catholic Church at that time had trouble accepting what science was finding. This is another Galileo moment people are pointing to right now, and most people don't know about it because the discoveries are so new. They've just been coming out the past 5 to 10 years to the public.
In the case of yourself and the founder of BioLogos you were just talking about, because you were both evangelical Christians at one time, does that give you a bit of an in trying to establish some dialogue with evangelical Christians and creationist believers? Or in some cases, is the reaction a little more sharp because they feel like you've betrayed them?
I think I certainly hope that I have a lot of empathy for people who are in the, especially the young earth creationist camp, but also all creationists, whatever type they are. I understand, I think, where they're coming from and why, and how difficult this is for people. I don't think a lot of what science presents is intuitive. I think it's not intuitive that we're moving at 1,000 miles an hour right now. It's not intuitive that the Earth goes around the sun. Those were not dumb people back then. They were very smart and intelligent, were making observations. And I think when you look at nature around us and its complexity, it's okay to gravitate towards intelligent design and look at that and say, you know, how in the world could this have come about through natural processes? And again, until recently, I don't think we had the evidence that we have now.
And so what is the new evidence that you find is the strongest stuff?
Well, it's in a lot of areas. There's endogenous retroviruses, which it turns out that 10% of our genome is made up of old, broken down, mutated viruses. The model is the HIV virus that produces AIDS. When this virus inserts its DNA to take over your machinery to make new viruses, it leaves a signature behind. It's very specific where it inserts and how it does that. And so it's very easy to go in and sequence that. And we share the same ERVs as chimps in the same location where they insert and same mutations. And, you know, there's human chromosome 2 fusion and just a whole bunch of other things.
Strengthening the common link between species. We'll come back and talk more with Dr. John Peters about evolution and creationism and how to maybe get those two sides talking once in a while. Join us back here on the Jefferson Exchange. We'll take your phone calls and emails as well as resume our conversation with John Peters back here in a minute 15. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Dr. John Peters. He's a physician in family practice in Portland, but he's also a traveler and lecturer on the subject of evolution and what he considers overwhelming evidence that, yes, evolution is, in fact, the way of the world and how we all got here. He was once an evangelical Christian himself and now attempts to find some chances to get into dialogue with people who believe in creationism and see if there's any common ground there. He's in Ashland for a couple of events with the Jefferson Center, and you can join us here on the Jefferson Exchange now at 541-552-6782. That's the lone phone number we have today, 541-552-6782, or send us an email to jx@jeffnet.org. I'm sorry, I made you launch into a discussion of things like retroviruses, endogenous retroviruses, just before the break. But let's pick this up again. The fact is that we're talking about genes and viruses and things that are very common between some species that certainly seems to strengthen the case for those species being parts of a family.
Yes, I think, again, not only do you find, for example, with the ERVs, that apes, orangutans, gorillas, chimps share these same broken down old viruses, but they're inserted in the same location, and sometimes they mutate and pick up the same mutation. So when you find two ERVs, endogenous retroviruses, that are shared between two species and they're in the same location, they're the same ERV, and some of them even have similar mutations, I think that the only reasonable conclusion you can draw is common ancestry.
Now, the talk you gave last night on Ashland, is this the one called A Whale of a Tale?
Correct.
And just during the break, you showed me some pictures of whale legs.
Yes.
That's a great place to start. Let's talk about whale legs.
And that is another, if you think about it, can be a type of DNA evidence, because why would a whale be able to make legs unless it had the DNA for it? You know, no designer would put the DNA, all the DNA there, to make very complex legs unless it had it as an ancestry. And humans, actually, there's about 100 cases of very complex tails that humans have grown. And so we carry the DNA for making all kinds of the vertebrae, the cartilage, the blood vessels, all sorts of corpuscles and nerves, that these are not tumors at the back of the legs. These are tails that occasionally humans grow. And so why would, if we didn't have those tails in our distant past, why would a designer put the DNA in there?
Well, and you point out that the whales apparently came from an ancestor that was a lot more like a deer. Is that right?
Yeah, it turns out that if you sequence numerous proteins down to the DNA level, whales and hippopotami are more alike than some whales to porpoises. And so you can look at DNA. You can look at another type of interesting thing that we find in our human genome, and that they're called transposons, or jumping genes. And it turns out that 50% of the human genome is made up of these transposons. It's huge numbers. If there's 3 billion base pairs, you're looking at 1.5 billion transposons. And it turns out that whales and hippos share the same transposons too. So lots and lots of reasons on the DNA level that it's, I don't think you can find too many mainline scientists who have not come on board that whales and hippos share an ancestry, and it looks like it was an artiodactyl. It was a even-toed ungulate, and that is has come out just in the last 5 to 10 years to the lay public. And so we have absolutely ironclad DNA evidence that whales are related to a land animal.
You belong to a secular humanist group in the Portland area, correct?
Yes, several.
Uh-huh. Okay, several, and speak fairly often. Do you ever get invited to speak before groups where the predominance of the belief is not in evolution but is in creationism?
Not too much. I've approached, and I've actually met with pastors to try to get them up to speed with some of the newer DNA evidence and stuff, and most of them are not interested. They don't seem to understand. I don't believe they don't understand the ramifications. This is an active area of dialogue right now within the Christian community, and they're having symposiums on it. The 2011, I think the June cover story for Christianity Today was on Adam and Eve and the DNA evidence that shows that there could not have been a historical Adam and Eve. The three different lines of DNA evidence. And so whether the pastors and the theists out there know it, they are sitting in the middle of one of the most, a tsunami of change that is going to come about, and it's here, just like Galileo and the theologians had to deal with it at his time. We also have to deal with the DNA evidence that's coming out of the comparative genomic research.
Given that you generally tend to speak to groups then that do already share your set of beliefs, then, I mean, is your general aim about establishing dialogue and establishing bridges to theistic groups, or is it just about disproving the things they believe in?
Well, I think that if you look at the history of Christianity and most theist groups, they find ways of accommodating. I mean, the Catholic Church, their official stand is that theistic evolution is present and true. Francis Collins is still an evangelical Christian, even though he knows all the evidence for evolution. And I'm not talking about just microevolution, which the Christians call kinds or Behrmans. I'm talking about macroevolution. I'm talking about Tiktaalik and going from fish to amphibians. And there's a special on PBS right now, actually, every Wednesday night for the next two nights, parts 2 and 3. Your Inner Fish by Neil Shumid. And so people are trying to reach out and get modern science back into, I think, the public discourse.
So there are people who can maintain both sets of beliefs, then? People who
absolutely.
Can coexist within a single person.
Yeah, and I think you can dialogue about that, whether that's congruent or not with scriptures and science. But the Catholic Church, BioLogos, Francis Collins, there are many, many liberal Christians and more moderate Christians who have found a way in their own mind to combine the two. I think it's mainly the conservative Abrahamic religions that are having a hard time with the DNA evidence. And also, it's not just DNA evidence, but there's been a tremendous number of fossils that have come out of Pakistan with whale fossils. There are over 30 genera now of transition forms and in fossils in whales alone. So we have DNA evidence, we have fossil evidence, and now you can also look at modern whales and see all kinds of evidence for a land animal. It really is overwhelming once you expose yourself to it.
Was your departure from Christianity, you mentioned from age 17 to 20 you're an evangelical Christian, was your wandering away from that mindset caused by the fact that you were studying biology and about to teach it?
Absolutely. I was working on my bachelor's degree in zoology at Arizona State, and John Alcock was an ethologist there, very good, from Harvard, and several of his other faculty members were just presenting the facts. They weren't going out to try and destroy anybody. This is why evolution is taught as a main theory in biology. I think personally science has done a disservice because most of the specials and documentaries that are presented to people show what we found out and they don't show how we know it. And you can't explain something that's not intuitive to people unless you show them how scientists know that these are true. And so when I give my lectures and presentations, I try to go down to the DNA levels, the base pairs, and actually show the two species and show how scientists have drawn their conclusions, not just what we know. Because if you just tell people what we know, it's just your opinion against their opinion or their PhD against your PhD. And if you show people, look, this is what the scientists are showing. And especially if you say, look, this material is coming from evangelical Christians like Francis Collins, who have no reason to bash Christians or other theists, Muslims or Orthodox Jews. This is just what we're finding.
We're talking to Dr. John Peters. He's a Portland area physician, and he talks a lot about evolution, done a lot of research into the subject matter and talks to groups about it. He's in Ashland for a couple of events with the Jefferson Center, one of which is to talk about how to engage people who do not believe in evolution in some dialogue. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800. Oops, no, you can't. Not that number. The only number we have available because of the fund drive is 541-552-6782. It's our Rogue Valley local number. If you get a busy signal, please try again, 541-552-6782. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. You mentioned presenting so it's not just a matter of describing what we know, but how we know it. So you like to get into the DNA evidence and really get down to the almost to the cellular level here. I like to joke about things going down to the molecular level, but you really do that here. How, though, do you present this in a way that keeps people's eyes from crossing? I mean, it can be fairly dense material, it sounds like.
That's difficult, and I think I'm more optimistic than I get feedback from. You know, it seems pretty simple to me.
But you've been at this, right?
I've been at it for a while. But I also, I think that where I come from, I've had to work very hard in my studies. And I joke with my friends that I'm a B-plus student in an A-plus world, both in medicine and on the PhD level. And so because I have to struggle to understand this, I think it gives me an ability to teach and empathetic to it. But usually afterwards, people do tell me that I didn't spend enough time on some of the basics, on assuming that our culture knows what DNA is, and sometimes I don't spend enough time on the basic blocks before moving on. I think it's very powerful to line up the transposon data or look at a string of ATCGs in a base along a DNA molecule and compare chimp-human. And you can see the pseudogenes, you can see the transposons, you can actually see what they're doing in the lab. And I think usually the light bulbs go on and people go, oh, yeah, I can see where one letter dropped out and that shifted everything. And then it's, you know, it produced gobbledygush and the protein isn't produced. So, but
AGCT of the proteins, is it right?
Those are the four base pairs, the alphabet in DNA. It's just like we have 26 letters. So
adenine, guanine, cytosine, and thymine.
And thymine, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, at least in DNA. And so, yeah, and you approach it and say, look, you know, we've got 26 letters in the English alphabet, and Russians have more in Chinese, good luck, but DNA only has four. So, you know.
It's an easier language to learn.
I think it is easier. Yeah, it's very repetitive.
Let's take a call. Here's Bill in Medford. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Dr. John Peters. We're talking about evolution versus creationism.
Yeah, good morning, Jeff, and good morning, Doctor. I'm, of course, very much favor what you're teaching about the evolutionary mode model, but I'm also equally as interested in teaching of our children a method of rational thinking. I'm talking about the scientific method of thinking. It is more generic, really, than just science. In our whole lives, we need to learn how to think rationally rather than fantasy. And so I'm talking more about the teaching process that we have, and I'm sure that you agree with that, but can you talk a little bit about what you're doing? I know there are several organizations that do advanced scientific teaching in this country, and I contribute to some of them, but can you talk a little bit about the more generic sense of teaching the scientific method?
All right, thanks for that, Bill.
You're absolutely right. I think that the scientific method is a lot of common sense and being skeptical, using different methods to go about finding truths. And that should be a universal way of thinking. the human brain is a marvelous thing at figuring out what's going on in the world. But because of our origins, we make a lot of errors. We are pattern-seeking machines. And so we see patterns where there aren't any. We also tend to make system one and two errors that the cognitive researchers talk about. And so the bottom line is that you have to actually kind of teach yourself to watch out for the mistakes that are naturally that we all make. And scientists make them all the time, too. Basically, the scientific method is a way of trying to get around the mistakes that we tend to make. And, for example, if our ancestors had a rustle in the grass, they were around a campfire and the grass rustled, you could assume that it was the wind, or you could maybe assume that it was a leopard and run. If you're wrong, you're lunch. And so we tend to assign agency and different things that aren't there because we have been selected to survive. That's one example. And so the bottom line is we need to start teaching this in middle school and high school. And we already do that a little bit. You don't go out and buy a car usually without driving it first. You do your research. You go online, Edmunds.com, Consumer Reports. And so the trouble with faith thinking is that it starts with a commitment to reality and then works backwards using confirmation bias. And that always gets you into trouble. And scientists are guilty of that also sometimes. So you've got to train yourself not to do that.
Is there a fear that you sense among people who are holding on to religion strongly that if they let any little bit of science in the door? I mean, because there are obviously many different stripes. You've already pointed out people who say, yes, I can believe in both. I can, you know, enjoy the stories in the Bible while knowing that there was not an Adam and Eve, for example. But is there a stripe of people who simply believe that letting any science in the door would invalidate the rest of everything they've learned?
Yes, I do believe that for some conservative Abrahamic religions, especially, evolution represents a threat. And I think Dawkins has said that science is very caustic to conservative religions because they're reading their scriptures more literally than some others. And when you do that, every scripture that I've ever looked at makes assertions and claims to history. And until the DNA evidence came along, we really didn't have any way of saying whether there could be a historical Adam and Eve. And now, through BioLogos and what they published an article in 2010, which outlined this, and there's been an ongoing debate between them and a group called Reasons to Believe with Hugh Ross. And you can read that online. It's all posted. But the significantly conservative Abrahamic religions will probably fight tooth and nail evolution to the end because it does threaten their interpretation of scriptures, which informs them about the origin and reason and how we got here and why we got here. And it unfortunately strikes at a lot of people's identities, especially their moral identities that have been wrapped up in their origin narrative. So it's very threatening to them. But I think it was back in Galileo's time too. I mean, when the scientific data comes out and it's so strong, you have to find, I think, to be authentic, some way of incorporating this into your worldview. And, you know, our job is to change our beliefs according to the evidence, not change the evidence according to our beliefs.
Well, you talk about the Abrahamic religions and the adherence to belief in creation, but have you spent much time in discussion with people from non-Abrahamic religions, Hindus perhaps, about how much they can accept the science of what happened to the world?
I haven't. I mostly because of my evangelical background was enmeshed more in the Western traditions and the conservative religions of the Christianity.
You mentioned a couple times now Adam and Eve and why the Adam and Eve story can't be true. There's three bits of DNA evidence there, you said?
Yes, and what I'm saying is a historical Adam and Eve can no longer be supported because of the DNA evidence that was found. Certainly, major religions, Christianity, look at Adam and Eve as a metaphor and that it took more than 6 days to create the world and universe, et cetera. But there's when you look at surveys across America, it's close to, I think, 46%, just under half of Americans think that the world is less than 10,000 years old and that evolution has not occurred. We have a big problem in this country. And then those people usually run for school boards and get involved in teaching and stuff. And so one of concern from many people in science is that we are losing out to the rest of the world because we're not teaching science as it really is. And if you look at the Nobel Prize people who are in the pipeline, you know, America has basically dominated that. But it looks like we're in trouble in terms of keeping our science up with the Chinese and Japanese coming behind us, and Europe, actually.
A whole lot more to discuss about evolution and creationism and how you get the two sides to at least talk to one another and who can prove their points. Dr. John Peters brings in a lot of compelling evidence. We'll come back and talk more with him and take your phone calls and emails as well. Back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 25. Don't forget, it's spring fund drive time. Please make that pledge call at 888-552-6191 or pledge online at ijpr.org. And thank you for supporting Jefferson Public Radio. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest is Dr. John Peters. He's a medical doctor doing family practice in Portland. He also does a lot of research into evolution and speaks to audiences about it, and also spent several years as an evangelical Christian before he got into the heart of his education. And he talks to groups not only about evolution, but also how to engage people who do not believe in evolution in dialogue. We'll get into the heart of that discussion just coming up here. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange. Our phone number, our one and only, 541-552-6782. If you get a busy signal, try again, 541-552-6782. Or go to our email address and send a line to jx@jeffnet.org. So we've already established that there certainly are people out there for whom belief in evolution and strong faith can coexist. But, I mean, for a lot of people, I mean, you can prove this until you are completely drained of energy, and yet proving doesn't matter because for some people faith is faith, right?
That is very true. There's been a lot of psychological research recently that was new to me when I started reading it a couple years ago, that they did some experiments with weapons of mass destruction and the Iraq War, and they presented evidence to people who were still thinking that was present. And they found some interesting things. They found out that the more evidence that you presented, the worse it got. People dug in and were going to defend their position. And also, the higher the education level, the better the person was at rationalizing. It didn't get better. Their critical thinking did not go up with a PhD. It actually got worse. And so this is all, there was a Boston Globe summary of this research that came out in, I think, 2010. Very, very fascinating that you reach a point where no matter how good your evidence is, it actually makes the dialogue worse.
We have an email here from Tim in Eureka. He writes, "The Big Bang in evolution is surviving catastrophe. Being anti-religion, anti-anything, does fit into the scientific model. The scientific model is becoming poorly understood by scientists due to the distraction of being anti-religion to the point where some scientists actually believe that randomness is a natural phenomenon. The strength of the scientific methodology relies on understanding the power of random, not having faith in it. DNA, the Human Genome Project, and linguists actually support aspects of the Noah story. Science has become very biased." Interesting perspective from Tim and Eureka. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I'm not trying to address that. I think there's a lot of assumptions there that you could tease out and test.
I know that claim has been made about people who are absolute supporters of evolution. Dr. Richard Dawkins is the one who comes to mind, that he gets bashed somewhat by being so strong a believer in science that he refuses to allow any element of religion into it, that he is just as blind, some people say, as people on the ardently religious side.
Yeah, I think the term that's bandied about is scientism, that where you try and label science as a religion. And I don't think that's true at all. I think when you look at science, it goes across all worldviews. There's geneticists who are Muslims and Jews and Christians and atheists, and there isn't any agenda that I know of except to find the truth. In fact, if you want to get a quick Nobel Prize and go down as good as Newton, just find something that's wrong with Darwinian evolution and macroevolution. I mean, they would definitely put some incredible accolades on you. You could be a star.
You've used the term transposon a couple of times. Can you walk us through that theory?
Yeah, those are interesting bits of DNA. At least in the human genome, I don't know about other species, these are the jumping genes, and they make up about half of our DNA there. Many of them are retrotransposons, so they have parts of viruses again. And they have the ability to jump out of your DNA, make a copy of themselves, and then insert back in. And so they're found all over the genome. And so if we've got 3 billion base pairs, there's 1.5 billion of them. And again, the principle is the same. If you find a transposon that is inserted in the same place between two different species, and it's the same transposon, and it has some of the same age mutations, the only reasonable conclusion that somebody should draw is that those two species shared a common ancestor.
Is there some fluctuation in our knowledge? I mean, you're talking about there couldn't have been a single Adam, a single Eve because of DNA evidence. It seems, I recall, maybe a dozen years ago, a story that there probably was one woman from whom a lot of our DNA is drawn at one time in Africa. And people did use the term Eve to talk about
it. But, yeah, there's mitochondrial Eve and there's Y chromosome Adam. And it turns out that every once in a while, a set of parents will have all girls or all boys. And when that happens, the Y chromosome, if they're all girls, goes away. And the mitochondria, which only come from women, if you have all boys, the mitochondrial DNA is lost for that generation. So if you – and by the way, you can go on Wikipedia and just – and just Google mitochondrial Eve, and it'll explain to you how this happens. But it turns out that if you trace the mitochondria all the way back, it goes back to a single individual, back to Africa. And it was about 150,000 years ago she lived. But she was – that's mitochondrial DNA. That's not the nuclear DNA. That's just a very small part. If you include all the nuclear DNA, there is no way that you can derive the human race currently from a pair. And so it's a very confusing situation. You have to look into it. I've run into many pastors who think that they can combine that and get the Noah story, et cetera. But – there's too many alleles, which are the different, like ABO blood group are alleles. There's too many out there to come from two individuals. There's linkage equilibrium, which are blocks of genes that have been broken up. There's three different ways of looking at this, and there's no way that a human pair could found what we have now. It's impossible. There was a population of about 10,000. When you do the math, that humans came, we came from a population of about 10,000. But it's an interesting story DNA is telling us. We almost went extinct. There was a bottleneck crash, and we came very close to not making it. And it turns out that Homo sapiens, when we left Africa about 65,000 years ago to found the current population that we have now, it was about 60 to 1,000 people that left Africa. And this is all coming out of the DNA. There's a Spencer Wells, who's a UK geneticist, approached IBM and the National Geographic Society about 10 years ago after he wrote a book. And they made a movie called Journey to Man. And he explains and traces back where we came from East Africa. But also in the middle of the movie, he shows you how scientists know. He actually goes to a PCR machine and he puts little coconuts or something on the African plane, and he details how these SNPs are formed, which are these little changes in the A and the T and the C and the G. Anyway, so I love him. I love the movie. It's 10 years old, but it's still pertinent. And he does a great job of explaining how scientists know that when we came out of Africa, what routes we took, why we came out of Africa, and how we came out of Africa. And it's really powerful stuff. And most religious people can fit this into their belief systems. But if you're a conservative Abrahamic Christian or Muslim or Jew, you've got a story of an Adam and Eve of, you know, less than 10,000 years ago, and you've got the whole human race being rebooted in the ark with eight individuals. So it doesn't fit that. There's no way you can make a literal reading of Genesis fit what we know now with science.
And what's the name of the movie again?
The movie is called The Journey of Man, and it's on YouTube. And
all right, we'll provide a link for that on our Facebook page. I want to make sure that people get a chance to look at that. Here's Grumpy John in Grants Pass on the phone. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Dr. John Peters.
Thank you, Jeffrey. This is a two-part comment question, so I sincerely hope you'll let me follow up. My first question is, in support of the creationist theory and against, air quotes, evolution, is simply the giraffe. You have an animal that You say the neck got long because it was eating the top leaves. Well, that leaves the young to die. So my first question is, can you briefly, and I really want to follow up on this, Jeffrey, please, can you briefly explain how you could change the mind of a creationist when confronted with the giraffe? You can't bend he's got blockages in his arteries so that the blood doesn't rush from his head or to his head when he puts his head down. You can't evolve to that.
All right, John, what's the second part of your question? Because we're getting a little short on time. I want to get them both in before.
Okay, the second part of the question is the solution. You do not have a conflict between creationism and the Big Bang Theory if you just take it one step further. In the beginning, there wasn't God who said, do this, and there wasn't inanimate matter that took a spark and made it. In the beginning, Jeffrey, there was consciousness, and consciousness is what made the rest of it.
All right, let's get a response from Dr. Peters. Thanks for that, Grumpy John.
Well, in terms of the giraffe, I think that you have to remember that individuals don't evolve, populations do. So natural selection would say that that there's variation within a population. There's some giraffes with a little bit longer necks than others. There's a drought that occurs, and the relatively shorter neck giraffes going to die out. Their DNA is going to be removed from the gene pool, and that over many generations you will end up with long neck giraffes. Now, they're very complex. They have, like I say, if you're a giraffe, if you go down to drink, you've got to make sure that all the blood doesn't run up to your body and stuff like that. And that's the main argument for intelligent design, is that things are too complex to have occurred through natural processes. But if you're going to bring up the giraffe, you brought up my favorite example of evolution. That's the recurrent laryngeal nerve, which is there are four nerves that go to my voice box right now that I'm speaking to you. Two of them on the top are very short, come off the vagus nerve. The two on the bottom loop around and go all the way down to the heart and come all the way back. It's like designing a larynx, a voice box, and driving from L.A. to Las Vegas by way of Brazil. No designer would ever do that. And the answer is in Neil Shubin's NPR stuff on OPB, and there's a reason that occurred, and you have to go back to Fish and see how it got trapped underneath the arch. And so when you really look closely at biology and species out there, it speaks evolution. It does not speak intelligent design.
You still have a family practice you're maintaining in Portland. Ever get into discussions with your patients about this stuff? Has it cost you any patients?
No, I have homeschooled very conservative Christians, and I do have a retired pharmacist who's a young earth creationist, and I make very clear that I don't bring up topics with him. He's very, very set in his ways and is not open to look at any of this. It's easy to get indoctrinated and kind of brainwashed by not going to the original articles and just reading in your own little bubble. It's important to get out and be skeptical of what I'm saying too. Go to BioLogos. Go to a Christian site, and he's going to present the material, and he has he's not an atheist, and he has no axe to grind except to expose himself to a lot of ridicule from his former Christians. He has no reason to do this except to cause pain to himself. Go look at the evidence yourself. Go put me to the test.
We'll put a link on BioLogos on our Facebook page as well. And I see your salon at the Jefferson Center is on Sunday, talking about how to engage creationists in discussion. What time is that on Sunday? 4:00. 4:00 at the Community Center in Ashland. Okay, thank you so much, Dr. John Peters, for joining us on the Jefferson Exchange today.
Thank you. It's been a joy to be here.